the Lamra Meditation Class, 29 of January, 2013. We're going through the graded stages of the path and trying to understand in great detail all the various facets and points that we try to gain understanding, realization of, progressively one building up on top of the other, so that we're able to put it all together in one grand vision of the entire Lamrim, but also we're able to see how each part supplements and fits in and networks and amplifies each other part as we become more and more familiar with each of the different points within Lamrim. That way we know how to apply various combinations of these teachings in different situations. And as we go deeper and further in our Dharma studies, we want to be able to network this with many other teachings that we receive as well. This is the only way, really, to be able to then successfully apply the teachings in our daily situations, when we know how to put things together and also how to actually apply it, make it relevant, use it. So in this Lamrim, there's no need today to go through a detailed review. We have these three scopes of motivation as our minds open up and extend further and further with greater goals and greater, stronger emotional states that drive us to reach those goals. So, better rebirth in order to be able to continue on the path, then liberation from all uncontrollably recurring rebirths, since that is only filled with various types of suffering, and then to attain the state of a Buddha, so that we're better able to help everybody else overcome this situation. All that is based on realizing that we have a precious human rebirth now, and to recognize it, appreciate it, appreciate how rare it is, and so on, what its causes are, so that we are going to take best advantage of it. We want to take best advantage of it because death will come for sure. We're going to lose it, and we never know when. And the only thing that will be of any help are the positive habits that we have built up on our mental continuum, that these will continue into future lives. And in the theme of being preventive measures to avoid suffering, avoid suffering of worse rebirths, avoid suffering of rebirth altogether, avoid the inability to help others out of suffering. So in terms of future rebirths, we fear that worse rebirths would be absolutely horrible, so we want to avoid that by all means. We put a safe direction in our life, see that there is a way out, in terms of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, in other words, getting rid of the causes of suffering on our mental continuum with the understandings that will directly oppose them, the way the Buddhas have done in full, or the Sangha has done in part. And the first thing to avoid worse rebirths is that we avoid destructive behavior, so the whole discussion of karma. But then we think in terms of any type of rebirth is going to have not only suffering of pain and unhappiness, but also the suffering of change. Our ordinary happiness is never going to satisfy. And we have the type of body, so all body and mind, the all-pervasive suffering that of course is going to get sick, of course it's going to get the sufferings of old age, of course it's going to have the mood shifts of going up and down, happy, unhappy, and so on. It's the whole basis for suffering. We want to get rid of that, which means that we have to overcome its causes, which is karma, the compulsiveness of karmic behavior altogether, and the disturbing emotions that bring that on. We understand that all of that is deriving from unawareness of reality. We understand how that drives rebirth with the 12 links of dependent arising. And we see that in order to overcome that with great renunciation, this determination to be free, that we need the higher discriminating awareness of reality to overcome the basic cause of all of the factors that bring about uncontrollably recurring rebirth. In other words, unawareness of how we exist. We need the discriminating awareness that understands, that negates, refutes impossible way in which we exist. To stay with that, we need higher concentration. To apply that concentration, we need higher ethical self-discipline. So this is the intermediate scope. But then we see that, that everybody else is suffering. We understand we have equanimity toward everybody in the sense of no attraction, repulsion, or indifference, because that was based on the disturbing emotions, what we were working on with the intermediate scope. So we're open to absolutely everybody. We see our connection with everybody, the kindness of everybody. We develop gratitude, heartwarming love. We want them to be happy, not to be unhappy, to get rid of the causes of unhappiness, to gain the causes of happiness, take responsibility to do that. In overcoming our self-cherishing attitude and think instead of cherishing others. And we set our hearts with bodhicitta on our not-yet-happened enlightenment. We realize that we can attain it, and we want to attain that in order to help everybody as much as possible. And in order to do that, we have to take the bodhisattva vows, we have to put them into practice with the six far-reaching attitudes: generosity, ethical self-discipline, patience, joyful perseverance, mental stability, and discriminating awareness. So this is the bodhisattva path that will lead to enlightenment. We've discussed far-reaching generosity and ethical discipline, and we are in the discussion of far-reaching patience. Far-reaching in the sense that it will bring us to enlightenment. So-called perfections, and it is like that. It's far-reaching in that sense because it is combined with the bodhicitta motivation and also an understanding of voidness. With the understanding of voidness, it becomes a Buddhist practice that we understand that person practicing generosity and the one that we're being generous towards and the act of generosity, all of these dependently arise on each other, don't exist inherently, separately by themselves. And in order to make it a Mahayana practice, it becomes held with the force of bodhicitta. Far-reaching patience, we saw, has three types. The patience of not thinking anything about those who do harm to us, disregarding them, disregarding that harm that they're doing, basically, and not getting angry with it. Then the second is the patience of readily accepting the suffering that comes to our own mental continuum, suffering involved with practicing the Dharma and helping others. And the third is the suffering to establish strongly firm conviction that we have to meditate steadily on the Dharma. We have been discussing the first of these, not getting angry with others, not thinking about, not, you know, really becoming fixated on those who harm us with hostility and so on. And the first aspect of it, which is what we've been dealing with is stopping impatience with harm done to us by harmful persons. For that, we looked at how anger is unjustified. We saw that it was unjustified from an analysis of the object, the one that we're angry with, and from an analysis of the subject, that is, we who are angry, are getting angry, and is unjustified from the point of view of basis, in other words, the cause for the anger. And we just have one little point that is left with that. We were looking, in terms of the causes, at Shantideva's lines, Both his weapon and my body are the causes of my suffering, since he drew out a weapon and I a body. Toward which should I get enraged? Blinded by craving, I've grabbed hold of a painful boil that's shaped like a human and can't bear to be touched. And so when it's bruised, toward what should I get enraged? The point of this we saw was that the anger is arising dependently, or I should say, not the anger, but the harm is arising dependently on many, many factors. It's dependent on the person who is harming us, but it's also dependent on our having a body that can be harmed. You know, it's part of the general all-pervasive suffering of samsara. There also, doesn't go into it here, but all the causes for why that person has caused harm. We saw that actually earlier in terms of why it's unjustified to be angry with them, as they're controlled by their disturbing emotions and so on. We ourselves are under the influence of our disturbing emotions, so everything has arisen dependently on many other things. So what is it that we're going to get angry at? If you deconstruct the whole situation of harm arising, you can't find one specific thing that would be the focus of your anger. So this is a way to dissipate that anger when we make the analysis in terms of voidness and dependent arising. Then the last point about this analysis of the basis, you know, of why we're getting angry, the causes for anger. Oh yeah, there was another quote that Tsongkhapa gave. Some out of bewilderment cause harm, and some being bewildered become angry. Which one is without fault, and which one is at fault? So it's out of confusion that person causes harm, out of confusion that we get angry. This second point here that Tsongkhapa made is analyzing our promise, what we took on, our commitment, in terms of the basis of this whole situation of causing of getting angry, why it's unjustified. And Tsongkhapa says, if it's improper for even Shravakas to get angry, even more for us when we have promised with bodhicitta to work for the benefit of everyone. This is referring to the fact that we need to remind ourselves that we are on the bodhisattva path. We have committed ourselves with bodhicitta and the bodhisattva vows to actually work to benefit everybody and to reach the point at which we can best benefit them. And so, why are we getting angry with anybody? This is something that we really need to work on, to overcome. We have that commitment. And so this involves the two mental factors that are present in any constructive state of mind, which is a sense of moral self-dignity and care for how our actions reflect on others. So moral self-dignity, we have self-dignity, self-pride about the fact that I'm on the bodhisattva path. Not that how great I am, but if I'm trying to follow the bodhisattva path, how can I get angry? You know, I have more respect for myself and for my commitment that I'm really going to try to control myself and to apply opponents. And I care very much for how it reflects on others. You know, all the other Buddhist practitioners and teachers and so on, if I am known as a Buddhist practitioner and I'm screaming and yelling and getting angry at others, what's this? Reflects badly on all of Buddhism, on all other practitioners and so on. So this is something that we need to remind ourselves of, you know, in terms of the our basis here at Tsongkhapa is taking basis for the why anger is improper from the point of view of our commitment. Shravakas, he's saying, well, they are committed to overcome disturbing emotions. So obviously, they would try not to get angry if we are just working for our own liberation. But we're working to be able to benefit everybody. So how do we get angry with them? How can we? So this is this last point about why it's improper to get angry with those who do harm. So let's think about this last point and think also about our commitment to the Bodhisattva path? And do we have a sense of self-dignity about it? And concern for how our behavior reflects on others? You know, as a teacher, it's easy, because then other people are looking at you and watching you, your students, and so on. So that helps you to keep things under control. But very few of us are teachers, Buddhist teachers. So are others looking up to us as well? Or looking to us? Certainly you could say from the point of view of general Maya on the teachings that all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are looking at us and watching us. But Shantideva says it very nicely. How can we let down everybody when we've promised to try to help them? How can we let them down by getting angry with them? We got the exact words, but that's in one of the early chapters. Okay. Any comments on that?
You practice like this, have this undercurrent of...
Right, so you're saying that...
You're not able to really use the methods. Still, you are a Buddhist, but you're not a Buddha.
Right, so you're saying that if we try to apply this in terms of being really caring about how our behavior reflects on others, and we don't want to let them down and so on, then we might just repress the anger that we feel with this thing. Well, I have to be a good Buddhist and so on, and this could become very neurotic in many ways. Because although we are trying to follow the Bodhisattva path, we're not Buddhas, so we still get angry. We're talking here about overcoming the anger rather than just repressing it. So we're dealing with an opponent in many ways. You know, there is... How do you oppose anger? You know, this we'll get to later in our hour today. How do you develop patience? And it isn't just saying, I'm going to shut up. Even when we're talking on the initial scope, how do we prevent ourselves or refrain ourselves from acting destructively? It's by thinking of the disadvantages that will follow from it. The advantages or the benefits of refraining. And on the basis of that discrimination, then we would naturally avoid the destructive behavior because we see what it, the suffering that it leads to. So similarly here, we're not just exercising self-control because it's bad to get angry and I don't want to let others down. But what we're doing is by remembering our commitment and so on, it reminds us to apply the actual opponents and not just repress the anger. And there are many opponent forces that we can use to avoid getting angry.
But normally in a context of other people, know them very exactly, then perhaps it's only the...
Right. So she's saying that it's very difficult to apply all of this because anger doesn't come in terms of just one incident. There are many, many factors, and you're a psychologist or psychiatrist, and so you know, you're aware and deal with many, many underlying causes and so on for anger arising. And so it's not so simple.
Fear, for example.
Fear and trauma from previous incidents, post-traumatic stress syndrome, I mean, all these sort of things are there. That's true. However, I think you have to remember that we are speaking here on the advanced level of motivation. And so we've been working all along with trying to understand causes for getting angry. I mean, anger was a topic dealt with in intermediate scope in terms of the mental factors and all the causes and conditions for disturbing emotions to arise you know, habits, referring to previous things that have happened to us and circumstances that we meet and influence of others and, you know, all sorts of things like that. So we have already trained ourselves to be able to deconstruct a bit the anger. So here we're just talking about a stronger form of being able to deal with anger, which is in the context of Mahayana, that we want to benefit others. So it's not just we don't want to get angry because it brings suffering and it makes us act in destructive ways. So this is part of a long process. And obviously, if we haven't worked on the disturbing emotions in general beforehand, we don't have any methods to apply here in the Mahayana context and the advanced scope context. So let's try not to lose where this teaching takes place in the sequence of Lam Rim. See, this is quite a mistake that a lot of people make, is they ignore all the earlier stages and just take these pieces of Mahayana because they're really nice. Be nice, be kind, don't get angry, and so on. But they don't have the basis for being able to actually put them into practice. Okay? So, that finishes this point, showing that getting angry is unjustified or improper. And then what follows that is a short section on showing that showing kindness, being kind, is proper or is justified, as opposed to getting angry with people. Be kind to them. Loving kindness is this word that is being used here. And Tsongkhapa says that we can develop that by thinking that everybody has been my mother, my father, my friend, and shown me kindness, so it's proper to be kind back to them. So this goes back to basic seven-part cause and effect meditation on bodhicitta. So we need to remind ourselves when we are getting angry with somebody. Next point is they're impermanent and they all will die at some point. Remember, this was one of the points in the nine points for equalizing our attitude toward everybody. Everybody's going to die sometime, and I'm going to die sometime. So what's the point with getting angry at anybody? And then the next point is, and they're all miserable. Everybody's miserable because of the three types of suffering and being under the control of their disturbing emotions. They cause themselves such unhappiness. So these are the points that we think of in order to remind ourselves of what is the opposite here of anger, is showing loving kindness toward them. They've all been kind to me, they've all been my mother and father and so on. They're going to die anyway. They could die in the next minute. So what's the point of getting angry with them? And they're out of control. They're all suffering. You know, when somebody is really very unpleasant toward us, it's very helpful to try to recognize that they are extremely unhappy. And that's why they are causing so much trouble. They're unhappy. They're suffering. If they were happy and everything was fine in their lives, why would they try to harm anybody? So these are helpful thoughts. Again, let's think about that. They're causing harm to us. We're being nasty. Causing harm doesn't mean necessarily they're punching us. Many, many ways in which they could be causing harm. I gave the example, we didn't put it on the recording, but before the class began, of now there is, you know, I live on a very popular corner and a busy corner here in Berlin. And there are street musicians very, very frequently. And surprisingly enough, there's one now in the winter as well, who is standing on the corner right across the street from me playing the accordion. And he started at around 10 o'clock this morning and went until 4 o'clock in the afternoon without stopping, playing the same three short songs over and over and over again, which I can hear quite well in my office room where I work. And obviously one could get annoyed with that, Fortunately, he plays not so badly, so it's not, you know, bad music that is coming. But how do you oppose that? You think of this poor guy. It's freezing cold outside. It was raining most of the day. He's standing there under an awning, mind you. But anyway, he's standing there, not that he's getting wet. And can you imagine how horribly boring it must be for him to play the same songs over and over and over again? He never stopped for 6 hours. This is the second day. He probably will be here for many, many days to come. Do you think of his suffering? What has driven him to stand there and do this? You know, to try to gain some pennies. That helps you to become patient with it. Not to get angry and to just ignore the music, its background. I can ignore the traffic noise, I can ignore the accordion music, which is more pleasant than the traffic noise in any case. So, this type of way of dealing with annoying situation, harmful, sort of annoying people that are potentially causing you harm, don't let it hurt you. You know, there are so many ways to deal with potentially harmful situations. A few weeks ago, my downstairs neighbor was having a birthday party, and it was going to be loud music with a lot of people till very late at night. And he informed everybody in the building and invited everybody to come to the party. I mean, this is the usual German custom for such things. And I don't like going to parties, so I was not planning to go at all. And it's directly in the floor beneath me, so it would be, I know, incredibly loud. There would be no way to escape it. And so what I did was give the victory to the others. And I slept at a friend's house. You know, I asked if I could sleep there, and I slept there, and then I informed my guy downstairs, you know, so that rather than the danger of me annoying you by complaining that you're too loud late at night, and you annoying me by being so loud, enjoy your birthday party, happy birthday, and I'm sleeping somewhere else tonight. And that was perfectly fine. So there are many ways to avoid, you know, to be patient. And here, wishing the guy a happy birthday, have a great party. Okay? So, what I wanted to present is how do we actually, this is taking a little bit of a sideline from Tsongkhapa's actual presentation, which is how do we actually gain the conviction to apply opponent forces here? We're dealing with several disturbing emotions, or several mental factors, I should say. They're not all disturbing emotions. First of all, there's anger. So you look, what is anger? Remember, we have this definition, so I'll repeat it. It aims at another living limited being, our own suffering or situations entailing suffering, and it's impatient with them. It wishes to get rid of them, such as by damaging or hurting them, or by striking out against them. It's based on regarding its object as unattractive or repulsive by its very nature, and it functions to bring us suffering. Hostility, which is our actual disturbing emotion here in the discussion of patience, is a subcategory of anger. It's directed primarily, though not exclusively, at limited beings. So we're not talking here in the Mahayana context of far-reaching patience, of being patient with our computer or, you know, something inanimate. We're talking about being patient with others. And it exaggerates it's based on a conceptual interpolation beforehand. Interpolation is you add something. And the interpolation either exaggerates the negative qualities of the object, or it adds negative qualities that it lacks. So it pays attention to the object in a discordant manner, a manner that's not in accord with reality, for example, incorrectly considering something not at fault to be at fault. You know, so it takes good qualities to be bad qualities. And it is often supported by a conceptual repudiation or denial beforehand of the good qualities of its object. This is hostility. You regard the person as negative in their quality, and you identify them with their negative qualities, and you regard them as their true identity. They're a terrible person. And we exaggerate those negative qualities, or add stuff that are not there, or ignore the good qualities, or somehow consider the good qualities as bad qualities. And it brings suffering. Right? So, what do we want instead with patience? We want, there's a mental factor called, actually, literally, non-hostility, which I like to translate as imperturbability. You can't be perturbed, which means disturbed. This is defined as not wishing to cause harm in response to limited beings. Well, the same thing, in response to limited beings, our own suffering situations that cause suffering. So in our context, it would be with others. It's not wishing to cause them harm. It does not imply total freedom from anger and hostility. And it serves as a basis for not engaging in faulty behavior. So this is quite interesting, because what we are trying to develop here first is not that you get rid of anger completely. That we're not going to be able to do until we become a liberated being. What we want to do is to develop more strongly this opposite of hostility, the not hostile, which means that we don't wish to cause them harm in response to their harm. We're able to endure it. That's the basis of patience. And then there's not being cruel, which is not merely this imperturbability of not wishing to cause them harm to limited beings who are suffering, or not wishing to irritate them or to annoy them. It has, in addition, compassion, the wish for them to be free of their suffering and its causes. So this is indicated here in Tsongkhapa's thing, that his discussion of why loving kindness is important here as an antidote. So we're trying to develop with patience in this context of working to enlightenment to benefit everybody, at least the wish not to hurt anyone, not to cause harm in response to their causing us harm, you know, not to get angry back, and some sort of compassion for them. Okay? You follow that? So now what I'd like to apply is a presentation of the four axioms for analyzing that Tsongkhapa mentions earlier in the Lamrim. This can also be called the four principles. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in a very detailed teaching of Lamrim, which has just recently been published in a book called From Here to Enlightenment, which is really quite excellent, His Holiness mentions very briefly these four and how to apply them in quite a profound way. You know, slightly different from the presentation that we have in Tsongkhapa, and I found this really quite wonderful. So, let's apply it here. First is the axiom or the principle of the nature of things. So, here His Holiness points out three things. The nature of the mind, that is, well, what's the definition of mind? Mental activity. And what is that mental activity? It is one action. That action has two aspects, giving rise to a mental hologram of something and some sort of cognitive engagement with it. And merely that, nothing else. There's no separate me or separate mind that's doing it or controlling it or watching it. There's no separate mind as a machine that's doing it. It's just an activity which is going on moment to moment to moment. giving rise to a mental hologram and a cognitive engagement, and it always says content, right? Second, that's nature of the mind, the nature of things. The second type of this principle of nature of things, the second point is subtle non-staticness, which is that mental states change from moment to moment, right? So there's always a new mental hologram that's arising. There's always a new type of engagement, cognitive engagement with it, many different cluster of different mental factors. And the third one, the third axiom or principle, is the incompatibility of mutually exclusive phenomenon. Hot and cold. Knowing, not knowing. They're mutually exclusive. General principle. Okay, so on the basis of that, then you start analyzing. What we're analyzing here is whether or not it's possible to change our mental state. It's very, very profound, the more that you think about it. How do we become convinced that it's possible to change your mental state, to improve? You have to become convinced that it's possible, otherwise you're not going to do it. So why is it possible? Well, because there's this mental activity that's going on all the time. Holograms and cognitive engagement. And it's changing moment to moment. And the content of it, you can't have two mutually exclusive things. So, you know, one will cancel the other. So now, the second principle, the second axiom, is the axiom of dependence, or the principle of dependence. What do things depend on? Anger depends on incorrect consideration. We saw this in our definition. It exaggerates negative qualities, right? What is patience? Patience is, here we're talking about the patience of not thinking about those who do harm, not focusing on it, not dwelling on it, you know, of all these negative things. What does that depend on? That depends on not being perturbed, not being disturbed by it, which depends on not exaggerating the negative qualities and on loving kindness. What does loving kindness depend on? It depends on focusing on the good qualities of others. Remember, we have the good qualities. Everybody's been kind to us, and you know, has been our mother and father. So, anger depends on exaggerating the negative qualities, right, and adding more and focusing on that. And patience depends on not getting upset, not getting hostile, which means not exaggerating the negative qualities, not dwelling on the negative qualities. So one is dwelling and exaggerating the negative qualities, and the other is not fixating on the negative qualities, but focusing on the good qualities instead. This is what anger depends on. This is what patience depends on. So you see, these are getting to be mutually exclusive here. Then the axiom, the third one, is the axiom of functionality. What the principle of functionality? How do things function? What is the function of things? What do they do? Anger, as a disturbing emotion, not only causes you to lose peace of mind. Here, His Holiness pointed out something which was, His Holiness didn't actually apply this. You know, I'm applying it, but His Holiness in another point here talked about how, in the definition of a disturbing emotion, remember there are two aspects. One is that it makes you lose calmness, mental peace of mind, and you lose self-control. So he says, lose peace of mind, actually compassion can make you lose peace of mind because you're so moved, you know, by the suffering of others, and, you know, you can become quite upset about that. So you don't just have an even, calm mind. But with compassion, you still can have control, self-control, because your mind is clear, but you are moved. So he says you have to have that second aspect here, and that makes it a disturbing emotion, that both you lose your peace of mind and you lose self-control. Very interesting point this Holiness makes. So, anger causes us to not only lose peace of mind, but also to lose self-control. That's its function. Patience, on the other hand, when we're not perturbed, when we're not disturbed by things, allows us to be calm, doesn't it? So one functions to make us not calm and to lose self-control. The other functions to make us calm. Being calm allows our discriminating awareness to function clearly. When you're not calm, your mind is disturbed, you can't think clearly. You can't discriminate between what's helpful, what's harmful. Between what are the negative qualities of somebody, what are the positive qualities of somebody. When your mind is calm, with patience, then you are able to discriminate. And what we have here, if we can go into the system of the five types of deep awareness, is the so-called Dharma Dhatu deep awareness, which is the sphere of reality. We're able to see simply, it's this and not that. Remember, with what anger does, is it adds grasping for true existence onto this. So, it's this and not that. So it's not that, so that's bad. It's truly not that and no good. And this is what I want and that's not what I don't want. And then you push it away and you get angry. So when you clear out that confusion, what you're left with is just the simple discrimination. It's this and it's not that. Person has this qualities and not that quality. That man across the street is playing the accordion for 6 hours, the same songs, and he's not going away. He's not being quiet. That's all. That's the fact. There is nothing else except the fact. Everything else, we exaggerate. He's playing the accordion. He's playing music. How nice. How entertaining. How sweet. That's one way of labeling it, isn't it? The other way is we make that into a negative quality. He's making noise. He's disturbing me. And then we want to push that away. So hostility. I don't want that. Me, I don't want that. You know, I'm the most important one. Is what's behind that. Not this poor man who, you know, is trying to get a few pennies so that he can eat tonight. Or maybe feed his children. So, we have this functionality. Okay, now based on these three, so we have the nature of things. Mind is just the arising of holograms and engagement with them. And it's changing from moment to moment, and you can't have two contradictory things as part of it. One will cancel the other. And then anger depends on incorrect consideration, exaggerating negative qualities, making good ones into bad ones, and so on. And patience means not being perturbed, which means not exaggerating the negative qualities, and with loving kindness, focusing on the good qualities. So, these two states, anger or patience, are depending on how we consider things. Correctly or incorrectly, calmly or not calmly. Functionality. Anger makes us not calm. We lose self-control. We can't discriminate clearly. Patience functions to make a calm mind. We can discriminate clearly. Just that it's this and it's not that. Without, you know, freaking out. Making it a horrible negative quality and so on. So then you have the fourth axiom, which is logic. If I develop loving kindness based on focusing on everybody having been kind to me, it will be mutually contradictory with focusing just on their negative qualities. And this will bring me to a state of imperturbability, not getting angry. With that, I'll develop patience. So it is logical that if I focus on the good qualities with loving kindness. Everybody's been kind to me. And they're suffering just as I am, and they will die at any minute just like I will. So, you know, you really feel warm and attracted, kind to them. This is mutually contradictory with just focusing on the negative qualities. And the two are contradictory. You can't have the two in the same moment of time, in the same moment of mind. And the mind changes from moment to moment, so it is possible to change how you regard things, and one will cancel out the other. With that, we become convinced to, that the method will work. We're developing patience, and that gives us the confidence to apply it. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So, this is from His Holiness, Dalai Lama, in terms of how you apply these four principles. So, do you follow? Now, think about it. And it's this type of logic, this type of sequence, that you really have to spend long time contemplating, thinking about it, till you really become convinced that the Buddhist methods will work. This is how you become convinced. This is part of the discussion of, hearing, thinking, meditating. This is part of the discussion of thinking with which you become convinced. You understand and you become convinced that it's correct, the teaching. Then in meditation you apply it.
Yeah. A little point concerning the logic.
Yeah.
When you said from moment to moment to go in the state of patience or anger, for example. But who does this? At some point we have spoken about feeling arising. That means that when I have planted enough seeds of patience, then done. And when I didn't, I can't think, okay, it's looking at it.
Well, she's saying that, first of all, we have the nature of things of subtle non-staticness, that subtle impermanence. Things change from moment to moment to moment. Because they change from moment to moment, then you can not necessarily instantly go from anger to patience, but in a sequence you could. Why? Because there is change from moment to moment. Because if there is change, and the change arises dependent on many factors, then it is possible to change. The anger isn't permanent, forever. No way of changing it. So then you're asking, well, who's doing this? Well, remember our definition of mental activity. Merely rising of a hologram and cognitive engagement. There's no separate me that's making it happen, or watching it, or controlling it, or out of control. Just happening. Me is labeled on the whole process. There's no separate me controlling it. So there is willpower, there are so many mental factors that are involved here. Perseverance and, taking joy and overcoming anger and all these sort of things that will support applying an opponent. And you're right, it won't arise without having all the causes there. And you're saying that you have to have planted all the seeds. That's true. However, this is the way that you plant the seeds. You build up the habit. And we already know, some of these methods in terms of, you turn on the water. This is assuming that we're in a place with running hot water. And it's too hot. So what do? You oppose it with a little bit of cold water. We know that. And it will change. Because it changes from moment to moment. It's affected. So we already know this is the nature of things. And to get more cold water, it depends on turning the knob of the sink, of the faucet. And that's the function of turning the knob. It will allow more cold water to come in, or more hot water to come in. So these are just basic principles, basic axioms of how the world functions. That's why they're so profound. But yes, it takes time. So this thinking process, over and over and over again, analyze. How do we become convinced that the method will work so that you will apply it? That's very important. Any other questions? Could you apply this in a different way, in a different example? What would be a different example? Here, Okay, we have the same axiom or principle of nature of things, right? Mind, mental activity, from moment to moment, hologram, and cognitive engagement, no separate me, changes from moment to moment, and you can't have two contradictory things. One will replace the other. So, what's the second one? Dependence. What does fear depend on? Over-exaggerating the bad qualities, right? Causing you to lose peace of mind, that it's that's its function. What else is with fear? Over-exaggeration of me, you know, I'm going to be hurt. And a feeling of helplessness, that there's no solution, there's no way to avoid it, isn't it? Is there anything else with fear? A psychologist, what else is with fear?
Resistance.
So that's the strong me.
I don't want
this to happen. I'm afraid of it. So there's some pushing away. So it's like this thing of anger, rejection. Pardon?
And then the fear grows.
Right, and the fear grows the more that that you resist, the more that you push away. Well, it's hard to say which gets, they reinforce each other. The more you push away, it means that you're more afraid. The more afraid you are, the more you push away. So, absolutely causes you to lose peace of mind and lose self-control, fear. What would oppose it? Acceptance of the situation could be, we're not denying that there's some problem. So, give an example of what you might be afraid of. Give an example.
An exam.
Okay, you could be afraid that you are going to fail the exam. Right? That's what you're afraid of. That I won't be good enough, etc. And all the consequences that will follow from failing the exam. And you want to push it away, you want to avoid taking the exam, and you're really upset. No peace of mind, and you're out of control. Can't sleep, can't eat, etc. Okay, so how would you oppose that? You're saying, see the reality. The reality is, here is an exam. I could pass it, I could fail it. That's the reality. I do my best to prepare for it, and then see what happens. You're not perturbed by it. You accept, this is the second type of patience, which is to accept difficult situations, suffering. To accept that this is a difficult situation, you could also label it as a challenge, you could label it as, you know, many things. You can think of all the other people taking the exam and their worries as well. Remember Shanti Deva's advice, if there's something you can do about it, just do it, don't worry. If there's nothing you can do about it, don't worry, because that's not going to help. So there is something you can do about it. With the exam, you could prepare. Right? So you prepare calmly, without exaggerating the negative qualities of, if I fail, then I won't get, you know, this or I won't get that, and you know, all these horrible things that could happen. Don't exaggerate that. Don't fixate on that. You don't have to fixate on the good qualities as well. If I pass it, I will be, you know, so wonderful. That also could lead to overconfidence. Just calmly, this will happen if I pass, this will happen if I don't pass. What's always helpful in fearful situations is imagine the worst happening and how you would handle it. What's most fearful is the unknown, isn't it? So if you know, well, if I fail, I can take it again. If I fail, I won't get that promotion. I'll stay at the same job as I am now. Not the end of the world. As in your example, I know you took a job for a higher position. And you took an exam for a higher position. So, we have here functionality. Fear is going to make me actually do worse on the exam because I'll be so nervous and upset. Being calm and patient with it will allow my mind to be clear so that I will potentially do better on the exam. I see the reality that what will function. If I'm really freaked out and afraid, I won't even be able to study properly. If I'm calm, I will be able to study properly. So we see how they function, what they depend on. And the logic then is, if I can develop this being not perturbed by it, I won't be afraid. And I will be able to do better. And then you apply the opponents, which would be to look more objectively at what are the possible, you know, what are the consequences of passing or not passing without exaggerating them, and see that you can handle it. That would be the way to apply this with fear. It's a good example. We have to calm ourselves down. Now, obviously, fear doesn't go away in an instant. Calm down. Fear of flying. You're in an airplane, and you're afraid that there's going to be an accident. What would Shanti Deva say? You can't do anything about it, so why are you worried? That's not going to help. The misconception is that I should be in control. And I don't like that I'm out of control because somebody else is flying the airplane. As if it would be better if we were flying it. And, you know, come on. Then the analysis. How can you be in control of anything? Everything arises dependently on a million factors. There's no way that you can be in control of anything. That's a myth. You can try to influence things. Nobody is in absolute control. So if I realize this, then I won't have this irrational fear of flying. You don't want to fly, don't fly. If you're going to fly, you know, I mean, don't be afraid of it. And then it depends on necessity. You might be afraid of skydiving, so don't skydive. You don't have to skydive. You're afraid of flying, well, there might be some emergency in which you might have to fly. You know, a parent is really sick and you have to get back home quickly in order to take care of them or something. There's an emergency. There's no time. The drive is too far. Or they're on another continent. You're not going to take a boat. So, there could be a necessity. There's never a necessity for skydiving unless you have to parachute from a plane because there's some problem and you have a parachute and you know how to use it. Is dependent on a lot of things, isn't it? So, we have these four principles and or four axioms, and they're very, very helpful. And here we're seeing that it can help us to understand why Tsongkhapa has here as the second part of his discussion of not getting angry with others, instead to think of loving kindness, remembering their kindness to us and so on, in terms of previous lives and all of that. Okay, so let's end with a final, just quietly thinking about that, and then we'll have the dedication. Okay, we think whatever understanding, whatever positive forces come from this, may go deeper and deeper and act as a cause for everyone, not just myself, to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all, without all of us being the truly existent one that's going to attain enlightenment, and without enlightenment being some truly existent thing that's up in the sky or inside of us waiting to pop out, and how all the stages for reaching it arise dependently on each other without being independently existent by themselves. So with that understanding of being for everybody and the voidness which is involved of cause and effect, we make the dedication. So both bodhicittas together, conventional and deepest. Okay, thank you.